There's the recordings going.
Good. All right. So we'll call the special meeting into order, March 31st, 2021, and start with roll call. Brendan Addis here. Marie?
Here.
Michelle Kirk?
Here.
Matt Jones?
Here.
Sue Marshall?
Here.
Justin Maynard?
Here.
Michelle Maynard?
Here.
Josh Seeds?
I don't think he's present.
Okay. And Charlie?
Here.
Great. You have a note on here for review packet information. Is this just kind of what you have forwarded, or am I missing?
There wasn't right, anything great on there for packet
no
wise.
Problem. No problem.
Forwarded the presentations just in case somebody has technical difficulties. So you'll.
No, thank you, because I do the meeting from my phone, so I'm able to pull the presentations up on the monitor at the same time.
Okay.
That's nice.
And I know there's a couple of videos and things like that that'll we'll have to just do separately, but that's something you can click on later. So.
And did we have any public comments submitted?
No, I checked a couple times during the day, and as of 6:15 tonight, we did not have any messages either from myself or emails or to the Clean Water Line.
Right on. Okay, well, moving forward then, I know we got three different presenters, and I don't know, do you want me to go in order here?
Yes, please.
Have any agenda needs? Okay. All right, well then, I was going to turn it over to Justin to start with your presentation first.
Since there's two Justins, did you mean Justin Colell?
Yes.
Oh, I did, yes. Sorry.
Okay. Great, okay, thanks so much. My name is Justin Colell. I'm the coordinator for the Clark County Noxious Weed Control Board. I work in public works. Our department is called Vegetation Management. We specifically handle all of the noxious weeds across Clark County. So if they occur on Clark County-owned property, then they're handed by the control program side. And Danielle Cowley is the lead field inspector there. And on the other side of things, I'm the lead field inspector for the field inspection program. We handle all of the concerns of noxious weeds on private properties, which is actually everything else. If Clark County doesn't own it, then I'm everybody else. So even if it's not private property, it could be Bonneville Power Administration. It could be the railroad, BNSF. It could be, federal land, anybody else. I'm the person to handle that. So I was approached after milfoil, Eurasian water milfoil, was found to be spreading in Vancouver Lake. And Friends of Vancouver Lake is a volunteer 501c3 organization that was created specifically to address this problem with Eurasian water milfoil found in Vancouver Lake. And it's been around in Vancouver Lake for many years. It was detected quite a while ago. But in 2017, it was found to be spreading quite a lot, very widespread. And so that's when the group really got together, took off, and started fundraising. So I was approached in 2019 and started putting together a plan for Vancouver Lake, known as the Integrated Aquatic Vegetation Management Plan. And that would address noxious weeds, but more specifically, the biggest problem with Eurasian water milfoil. So, and I'll just call that milfoil. There are other species of milfoil that are native, but if you hear me say milfoil, just assume it's the invasive variety. That's pretty common throughout Washington State. So, admittedly, my expertise is terrestrial noxious weeds, so I've had to do a little bit of homework and research to really do this plan justice. But the plan makes recommendations, and it was funded by the Department of Ecology of Washington. And that grant was actually applied for by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they kind of subcontracted the actual writing of the plan out to my group, Vegetation Management, so me. So the plan addresses the noxious weeds. Vancouver Lake has, several problems as far as habitat, ecology, and usability for people, our community. It has lots of problems. But specifically, this plan just looks at the noxious weeds. So it's not designed to go after every problem and doesn't address, for instance, phosphorus or other contaminants. But as such, I can speak to, the noxious weed side of things. can't quite go into everything else, even though I am aware of it. It's just outside the purview of this plan. So to make it brief, the plan recommended treatment for Eurasian water milfoil and monitoring after the treatment. So before any treatment was done, we took a survey of the lake in kind of a square grid. We took several points throughout the whole lake, targeting the 4 foot and shallower area of the lake, because that's where milfoil is likely to first start colonizing. Since Vancouver Lake is very turbid and very murky, doesn't have a lot of sunlight, so that's where the weeds start. And we found a lot of milfoil when we surveyed in 2019. Well, Friends of Vancouver Lake was successful in their fundraising, and they were actually able to treat Vancouver Lake. They had tried to get it done in 2019. They could not. But they treated in 2020. And then we surveyed right afterward and used the same protocols to do several hundred points throughout the lake. And we didn't find any milfoil. The treatment was very successful. And we are, as per the plan, we are planning to go back again this year, and this year do the same sort of survey, and check and see if there's been any milfoil regrowing, if there's any that we can find at all. And so I look forward to that, and would like to see, how effective this treatment was, for several years, because it's rather a novel approach. It's a very, very new herbicide that has only been used in a few other places in Washington, and like I say, quite new, registered basically right before being able to be used. So it's very interesting in that respect. And that treatment wasn't done actually by Clark County. It was actually the Friends of Vancouver Lake who hired the contractor to do that. Clark County has since obtained a grant. We applied for a grant and received a grant from the Department of Ecology to manage this infestation. Right now, that's taking the form of these surveys, because admittedly, there's no milfoil out there right now to treat. But should we find milfoil, we do have another grant from Ecology to actually control the milfoil as well. And that's a short-term grant that would just be for this year. And then if we're quick, we might be able to get treatment done early next year. But the grant period runs out in spring of next year. So with that said, I'd be happy to take questions that you guys might have to fill in any gaps that I might have left. And kind of fleck out anything that you guys are interested in.
Well, I guess I would, this is Michelle Gertz. I would ask if you are planning on needing to do this kind of treatment, you know, every year, what the full, you know, operations plan is around this treatment.
Yeah, since this is a new herbicide, it's called Procellacor, that's something that I haven't had expertise with to be able to get a timeline for that. But that said, the survey results were very impressive, and we worked closely with David Heimer of Fish and Wildlife. And he was also impressed with the results of our second survey, post-treatment. And this company that produces Procellacor, in some times, is able to guarantee no returning milfoil for 3 years. Mm. So, with all that in mind, personally, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see milfoil at all this year because of the results that we saw immediately following the treatment last year. And it would be likely that next year the amount of milfoil that we find is low enough that it wouldn't meet the threshold of a widespread treatment like we did, or excuse me, like Friends of Inkler like did before. So it might be a very small treatment in comparison if it were to occur.
Justin, this is Brendan. Do you know when they're looking at it not coming back for 3 years, does that have something to do with the plant's growth cycle and biology, or is there a persistent effect to the herbicide application?
Yeah, I can speak to that. The herbicide is not persistent at the levels to be active. It breaks down pretty quickly. It also is used at the parts per billion level and is effective in dissipating. Since it's used at parts per billion, it's very quickly no longer effective. The advantage with this herbicide is that instead of other herbicides, which basically have to bathe the plants for long periods of time, this one tends to enter the plants very quickly and is extremely effective and essentially wipes out all the plants that were there. So effectively that it needs to actually have, seems to be like it would only come back from reintroduction. New milfoil coming into the lake from other sources. Now that sounds great. However, you have three sources that can potentially reintroduce milfoil every single year. And that would be Burnt Ridge Creek, which doesn't have a lot of water flow into the lake. So even though there's definitely milfoil in Burnt Ridge Creek, that would be pretty slow. Lake River, which contributes a lot of the water flow at certain times. It kind of goes back and forth, depending on the time of the year. But Lake River contributes a lot of inflow to Vancouver Lake. Now, we did survey up Lake River for quite a ways and noticed that the milfoil was gone in Lake River as well for quite a ways. So that's probably going to play into it less. But the third is maybe the most significant, which is the Columbia River. It says connected by the Flushing Channel that Port of Vancouver has. And the Flushing Channel and most definitely the Columbia River had milfoil. And the Flushing Channel was treated along with Vancouver Lake, and that treatment was also successful. But the Columbia River was not treated and really cannot be treated in the scope of in the scope of this project. Wouldn't be feasible. So reintroduction from the Columbia River is almost a guarantee, depending, of course, on how much milfoil is able to get into the Flushing Channel and how quickly. You're likely to always find that there will be reintroduction of milfoil from Columbia River. That's just kind of how it is. There's milfoil in the Columbia River all the way up into Canada. And in Canada, they are not taking as much of the active approach as they do in the eastern parts of Washington. So it'll always be there in the headwaters of the Columbia. So that's unfortunate. But as far as Vancouver Lake and the amount of milfoil, like I talked about before, meeting a threshold of actually doing harm to, let's say, you know, boating and the habitat, it might not meet that threshold for 3 years or beyond.
And then the other question I had with regards to the herbicide effect, is it designed particularly to only affect the milfoil, or are there other plant species in the lake area that it can affect as well? I know with herbicide application, you can be specific for like broadly for grasses and stuff, and didn't know how this one particularly targets the milfoil.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The selectivity of an herbicide is one of the unique characteristics for each chemistry. With Prosellacor, it's extremely selective for milfoil as a family. If you're talking about the native species of milfoil, well, yes, it absolutely will kill the native species of milfoil at the rates that it is used for the invasive milfoils. But as far as other species that are native, it might affect them a small amount and cause some yellowing and cause some twisting of the leaves. But the company has said that it won't kill the native plants in a significant way, and that they'll grow out of any of those symptoms that I just described. That's one of the things that I'm most keen to observe when we do our survey this year, is to see what the native plant population looks like, because Vancouver Lake has been pretty algae dominated for, well, as long as I've been aware of it. Macrophytes or larger plants that are not algae have really not been able to compete effectively until we've seen this plant growth of the milfoil. So when we take out all the milfoil, it's reasonable to assume that we're going to see a return to the algae-dominated nature of Vancouver Lake, just because something is going to try to use the sunlight, and with how murky the water is, it seems to favor the top few inches that algae can utilize. And seems like what native plants are able to survive out there in Vancouver Lake are probably going to be competing mostly now against the algae. We didn't find a lot of plant life out there as far as what percentage cover the lake actually has, but we did find some. And I would be interested to see if we find the same diversity and, you know, even the same amounts this year, since it's, you know, been some time post-treatment, that's one of the things I'm most curious to observe.
Is there any interest or possibility of treating what there is at Burntridge Creek? And also, I will say, I found the website for this product, and that's what I sent in the chat. It does describe a couple other weeds that it takes care of. I don't know if they're in the same family or not, because I don't know about weeds, but anyway.
Yeah, I will say that one of the most significant runner-up populations of noxious weed that's on the noxious weed list for Washington State after the milfoil is curly-leaf pondweed. And Procellacor, unfortunately, doesn't do anything about that weed. So if and when anybody would look at controlling that one, which is not as widespread as the milfoil was in Vancouver Lake, but it is there. There are some areas where, you know, that's all there is the curly-leaf pondweed, similar to the mats that we saw with milfoil. We would have to use something else because that's not one of the weeds that Procellacor goes after. But yeah, Procellacor can be used for a few other noxious weeds as well. And to answer your question about Burntridge Creek, the Friends of Vancouver Lake have expressed interest in treating Burntridge Creek. I'm not sure if they will be able to get permit coverage, their contractor for Burntridge Creek, and even if they're interested in that, I'm not sure that they would be able to effectively treat that entire creek. I don't imagine that would be quite as straightforward. There are a few dozen or so, about a dozen, different landowners for Vancouver Lake. But when you start talking about Burntridge Creek, all the landowners that are close to Burntridge Creek, or actually have, you know, creek running right through, that'd be quite a lot more. I don't know that number off the top of my head, but unless they were really effective, I don't think that they would be able to find every population along Burntridge Creek. That's, you know, again, the difficulty there would be a lot more. Maybe they'd be able to do so right where it gets into Vancouver Lake, or maybe a little bit ahead of that, but there's been milfoil found lots of different places throughout Clark County, so unfortunately, it's pretty widespread.
So, Michelle again, is there any exploration once again of changing hydrologic conditions in Vancouver Lake to limit the compatibility with this reestablishment of the milfoil, as well as perhaps the algae?
All right. Yeah, that's a good question. And when I talk to experts like Jennifer Parsons with the Washington Department of Ecology, what she has noticed is that shallow lakes like Vancouver Lake, with the nutrient load like Vancouver Lake has, tend to be dominated either by algae or by macrophytes, the large plants that are not algae. It's usually one or the other, and you can't really get away from it being dominated by something. Something's going to use the nutrients, the phosphorus, that's available, and the sunlight. And so you're not likely without quite an aggressive campaign, you're not likely to be able to modify the lake such that it's not a big mud puddle. And the things that I generally recommend for somebody who has a noxious weed infestation in their pond just aren't applicable for Vancouver Lake because of the scale involved. So making the water body less shallow, so there's more of a hurdle for the weeds to overcome when they want to attach to the bottom or have nutrients available by locking up those nutrients. Both of those things are really, with today's technology and budgets how they are, not feasible for Vancouver Lake. There was some dredging done way back in the day, but dredging hasn't been done for a long time. And it's slowly filling in with more silt deposit. And the phosphorus levels in Vancouver Lake are so high that they're pretty much orders of magnitude beyond the threshold for what algae and, other plants would need to sustain growth. So there are some new technologies out there that do lock up the phosphorus so that it's no longer available for the plants to use. But those are quite new. In the one that I'm thinking of specifically is called PhosLock. That one is quite new. And again, the cost involved for that operation is prohibitively expensive. So for the size of Vancouver Lake, to get that done, it would be very, very intense. To say nothing of the continued reintroduction of phosphorus from, Burntbridge Creek and all the sources that Vancouver Lake has. So that part's pretty bleak. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like Vancouver Lake's likely to change anytime soon. You know, the toxic algae blooms and general poor water quality. I'm sure Jeff Schnabel could speak to that. He was on the steering committee of the IAVMP, and I'm sure he could speak to the outlook for Vancouver Lake and what it might take to address some of the other concerns beyond just noxious weeds. But specifically, the cultural controls to reduce the capacity of the lake to harbor weeds. Those are, like I say, prohibitively expensive, unfortunately. The IAVMP did recommend that if budget wasn't really an issue or was less of an issue, if somebody had a lot of money, the next most feasible option could be to install a bottom barrier, which is a screen or mesh that's tight woven, and covers the bottom of the lake such that in an area where you cover, say a boating lane or a swimming area where you want people to be able to swim, that would block plants from being able to root on the bottom of the lake. And if you do that, then you would have that sort of cultural control that would block out an area from having milfoil. But of course, the problem with bottom barrier like that is that it needs to be reinstalled every year to ensure that it doesn't have holes and to ensure that it doesn't just get covered over by silt again. And so that's a lot of labor and a lot of expense. So that's really the only runner-up option for cultural control until we really see a price difference in phosphorus sequestering products.
Justin, if I may, I was going to bounce a little pipe dream I had on this idea off of you, just because you seem pretty well-versed in the details of the situation there on the ground. what would be, and this would be obviously a long term, and talk about budgets and everything, so it's more kind of like, as the long term, you're mentioning the lake is slowly filling that sediment incoming. But kind of integrated man-made wetlands, almost wetland islands around kind of the periphery or the entry from the creek in particular coming in where most of your nutrient load is feeding in, that you would have other plant communities you would kind of be controlling and fostering to help uptake that phosphorus load and, it, you know, kind of controlling that eutrophication that's happening.
Yeah, options like that that have been explored, that's a good one. Another one that I've heard is to have a pump. A lot of the Friends of Vancouver Lake are very keen on the flushing channel and widening it and or having pumps to really, really drastically increase the water flow. Actually get some flushing action so we can see the sediment being washed down the Columbia. And I can't speak to that maybe as knowledgeably as with noxious weeds, but it stands to reason. I would think that if you were to, you know, essentially fill in parts of the lake and use maybe the dredging to fill in, kind of like they did when they created the island in the middle, and reduce the size of it, make it deeper, and like you're saying, have native plant communities in sort of marshlands that would be able to take up the phosphorus to a degree. That sounds very reasonable. Again, you're talking about dredging, which is another, high-budget intervention, but certainly increasing the flow to sweep out the sediment and reducing the size so that you have a smaller area where you're trying to, you know, flush out the sediment. Both of those stand to reason. I heard one proposal of installing a windmill that would power the pump, and therefore, you know, you don't have the power requirement so that it would pump whenever there's wind. And, you know, all of those are interesting ideas. I couldn't really speak to the, you know, feasibility or budget constraint of any of that, but it seems to make sense. I don't know who would take the lead on that, as it seems like no one agency really wants to claim all of Vancouver Lake. It seems to be kind of a hot potato, unfortunately.
Well, that's great information, and it's nice to hear you guys achieved your objective fully there with that treatment.
Yeah, I was very impressed. Like I say, very interested to see what sort of numbers we get for the native plants and how long the milfoil is kept at bay, and interested to hear about Procellicore in general since it's such a new chemistry. But very interested with it overall.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your work and taking the time to talk with us today. If nobody else has any other questions, I'll let you go, or at least pass on the microphone.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on, and I'll take my leave and get back to my kiddos.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks.
And thank you.
You guys have a good day.
All right, Bob Patterson, if you're ready and want to take the stage.
Where'd he go?
Good evening, Clean Water Commission.
You're not showing Bob the screen. It's not showing. There it is.
Yeah, it's showing.
Now it is. Thank you.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by way of introduction, my name is Bob Patterson. I'm with Clark County Public Works in their Clean Water Division. I've been with the Clean Water Division for about 6 years now, well over 6 years. I've been with Clark County for over 25 years in waste management, business assistance programs, septic programs, and I've also been in resource protection with overall for about 29 years now. So I come to you this evening with a bit of experience that I want to share with you, specifically tonight about source control. And if I can get my page to advance here, we can talk about introductions a little bit more. That's me peering into a hole there. And that's me in a nutshell. I think I bring something to this program that is a good fit for me and a good fit for the businesses that I work with, because I'm a bit of a people person, and some people don't like being people, but I enjoy people. So if you don't get anything from this tonight, I think the first slide is the most important one. Excuse me here a second. In that, this is it in a nutshell. The older portions of our MS4, our stormwater system, don't have the built-in protections to retain or treat stormwater. Here on the right, you have a gentleman up off of Highway 99 that has to clean stuff up for his business to run, for his business to work. And in the course of work that we do, we engage the business community through source control to help them contain pollutants and protect stormwater. Here in the old school setting, with the help of some mapping and the picture off to your left there, you can see that this gentleman is basically on the shores of Tenny Creek, washing off a greasy bumper with a power washer over a drain in his parking lot. And he may or may not know exactly what he's doing, and he may or may not care, but it's our job to relay both of those to him in the process. So we'll start with that and we'll end with that. First of all, why we do source control. Source control is required under our NPDES permit. Section 5C8, there's a great deal of detail there. I'll go into a little bit of it. But under permit, we are required to reach out to our business community and control pollutants. We also have a partnership with the Department of Ecology that we've been a part of going into our fourth cycle now. They're 2-year cycles. And in that, under that partnership, we're provided some funding per business to help businesses better manage dangerous waste and waste materials and materials that may create pollutants that may affect stormwater and may also be disposed of, managed, and managed improperly, creating pollutants in the process. Those two are the drivers, and they're all backed by Clark County Code 1326A, which basically says you can't pollute the waters of the state and the waters of Clark County. Under our, and I'm going to keep this really simple for everybody tonight, because we could go down trails and we could spend hours here talking about all the minutia of source control and what drives it and what we have to do in response to the permit. But in a nutshell, again, source control permit requirements require that we create a business inventory. We need to know the businesses and the business sites that are in our permit area. We need to know where they are, and we need to know who they are. And then that same permit requires that we visit, inspect, and visit annually 20% of that business inventory. And what are we visiting them for? Well, we're there to identify pollutants, and we're there to implement best management practices at those business sites so that we can better help them protect stormwater. I mentioned a business inventory. Here's a quick snapshot of it in 2017, because we don't have business licenses in Clark County. We used our GIS services through personal taxes or through property taxes to identify over 2,000 businesses in our permit area. We used Ecology's guidance under the permit to prioritize those businesses through Appendix 8 and through NAICS codes and SIT codes to develop a higher priority list of businesses that pose a risk, or the risk of creating pollutants in the work that they do. We use permit area sites identified or connected to the ability to impact the county's stormwater system. We have businesses on the east side of Clark County where the drain specifically to the ground, and that didn't fit with our MS4 requirements. So we narrowed the number down even further. And then those business sites in the permit area that were characterized by 8 and Appendix 8 and had the potential to pollute our MS4 brought us down to about 600 high-priority businesses. So those 600 high-priority businesses have to be seen or have to be contacted during the permit cycle every 5 years, but they have to be visited to at the level of about 20%, which gives us about 120 business visits a year that we do in the course of the work. I also mentioned that we have a PPA partnership, a Pollution Prevention Assistance Program contract with Ecology. That is a biannual contract. There are 26 partners, there's 26 to 30 partners in the state of Washington, from Spokane to Southwest Washington, and it's heavily populated in the Puget Sound region. All those partners work together, and they also compete for a limited amount of funding to do these business visits, and that translates to about 150 business visits a year that we do in our program underneath that partnership. It provides a funding source for us, it provides some consistency, and we also enter all of our business visits into a database that's provided to us through that. So it's a neat way to track things and report things. We are in the middle of applying for, we're about to apply for that very contract coming up next. And then as we look at those two drivers, there's a bit of a sweet spot where they overlap. On the left, you'll see our MS4, our regulatory requirements for business visits and inspections. On the right, you'll see our source control partnership or the PPA partnership. We also do commercial business inspections or commercial facility inspections. So when we're visiting a commercial facility to make sure it's in compliance, we have an opportunity to do source control visits while we're there. But we've got that little sweet spot where they overlap, and that helps us pay for some of those visits. And it's kind of how the whole thing works. And again, it's all backed by our Clark County Code 1326A, protecting the waters of Clark County, the waters of the state, specifically from the business community in our permit area. So source control, we find problems, and we fix problems, and we don't fix them ourselves. We use best management practices, or we encourage, in some cases we enforce, but we like to stick with the encourage part because it's a whole lot better to drive people with carrots than it is with sticks. And so we're constantly out there engaging the business community, searching for sources of pollutants, searching for business activities that can affect stormwater quality, and then fixing those problems. And we fix them with best management practices. Best management practices come in two flavors. They come in the operational kind, and I like to summarize that by saying this is the way we work. And we also fix those problems with structural best management practices, and those are the things that work for us. And I'll explain those a little bit as we move forward. Operational BMPs are really pretty simple. I spend a lot of my time telling people what to do, of course, like a lot of people do, but it's do this, don't do that. For example, an operational BMP would be to sweep it up instead of get out a hose and wash it off the pad or wash it off your work area. Inspect and repair to avoid a mess before it gets worse. Take this operation inside. There's no reason you have to do it outside. I know it's a nice day, and I know you want to be outside, but you're really making a mess out here. Maybe we could take that indoors, where it wouldn't come into contact with stormwater. Capturing some of those pollutants right at their source, reducing pollutants through efficiencies, something as simple as using a drip pan. The list goes on, and these are very, very simple But our business community is busy. They're busy making money. And a lot of times they're busy making a mess at the same time. Another form of BMPs or best management practices are structural BMPs. At the top of the screen, you see a facility piece, actually, which is an oil-water separator. Polluted water travels through the oil-water separator. Oil settles out, attaches to those plates there, and cleaner water moves out on the other side. Something very operational, something very structural in nature. The red wash pad below is at one of our car detailers. A lot of times I engage car detailers that are working outside and washing their pollutants off on hard surfaces and to the nearest drain. This particular car detailer was able to take it inside, and that's great during December when it's hard to detail a car outside in the rain. That wash pad is vacuumed off, and that wastewater is sent to sanitary sewer. Something as simple as a lid covering that 55-gallon drum that happens to be full of grease and oil, or in some cases it's greasy motor parts, things for recycling. A lot of times one of the things that initiated that particular yellow cover there was a 55-gallon drum full of oil filters that a local Jiffy Lube type business had just been setting out, and people kept stealing the metal lid to recycle. So I gave him a plastic one, and he keeps it on there all the time now. And then off to your right there, you see another metal bin with a simple awning over the top of it. These are some real simple examples of structural BMPs, basically eliminating the opportunity for pollutants to come into contact with stormwater and then get washed off. I want to touch a little bit just on some stormwater basics. You probably all know this, but one of the two things that I'm constantly telling the people that I work with when it comes to stormwater protection is the systems in place that are in place now are meant to hold the water back so it doesn't all go at once and cause erosion downstream or carry pollutants with it. And then while we hold that water back, we clean it up as good as we can. We have plants taking up nutrients. We have a lot of pollutants settling out. And here you see a big picture of a lot of the systems in play at commercial properties throughout our permit area. So here we have a basic business on Highway 99 that sells cars. And you can't sell dirty cars, and you can't get a car from an auction in Texas and bring it in without detailing it first. And all that detail activity usually happens out back. And all those pretty shiny cars are out front where people can see them. When we approach a business like this, we rely heavily on mapping to tell us where these things are, where the stormwater is going for an older site like this. Typically in this area, a lot of things still go to the ground, but when we put the map layer over the top of this, we get that aha moment for a lot of businesses where they go, I didn't really realize that that's what was happening. And that little drain out back where the buildings come together is where all the detail work happens, where the washing happens, the polishing happens, and all those pollutants gets washed right down the drain and right out to the county stormwater system, the MS4, there along Highway 99. Again, BMPs are the first choice in getting something like that corrected. This particular business went out and bought a wash mat, pumps it off now, and sends it to sanitary sewer. Here's something a little more advanced. In the mid-90s, we started putting more and more controls in place to protect stormwater. Here's Matt's garage a little further north on Highway 99. And you can see a bunch of bay doors there where business happens. From the air, it looks like a pretty clean operation. There's opportunity for spills here. Everything happens indoors, but pollutants can be generated throughout work like this. When we put the layer over the top of it, we see a lot of controls in place here that last business didn't have. The blue dot in the center of your screen is an oil-water separator. The red square off to your right is a filter cartridge designed to filter out stormwater that's coming off the street here. And then all across the top, the blue channel there is a bioswale. And this is a protection measure. This is a protection measure. And all that happens before it ever gets to the MS4. A little closer look, you can see some of those systems opened up. The oil-water separator, the filter cartridge, the inlet off the street, the bioswales, and the channel drains around the business. And an opportunity for a spill control in a sense, too. Just inside those bay doors, we have 55-gallon drums with products and waste products. Car pulling in and out of there could easily knock a drum over. And that channel drain in front of the garage would catch a lot of those pollutants. They'd wind up in that oil-water separator first. And if they made it out of there, they'd go to the bioswale after that. So there's a lot of opportunities here with systems in place to continue to protect stormwater from the business that's working out over the top of it. So sometimes it's pretty easy to see what's going on when we're out there looking for pollutants, when we're working with the business community. The catch basin is usually our first line of defense. Off to the left, we see a mistake. This particular business recognized it as a mistake. It wasn't too hard to argue with that. Off to the right, we see one of the dirtier fueling operations we have in our permit area. And that's a problem. We've made some real strides in that one under new ownership just recently. Last year, where that drain is blocked off and all this material is washed down and vacuumed up in the process. Not too far away from that catch basin is one oil water separator, and after that is the county's MS4. And just down the street from it is Cold Creek. So, again, best management practices put into play to control some of these pollutants. Here we have a dry cleaner a little further north off 10th Avenue. It wasn't too hard to figure out what was going on here. The dry cleaner would come back to the business at the end of the day, and if the shop was closed up, he'd just let his tank loose right in the parking lot. I have a little bottle of storm water from the catch basin over on the left, and a little bottom of whatever came out of his catch basin right there was. We blocked that off. We had him pump it out, and we made sure that all of his wastewater went to sanitary sewer, because it certainly didn't belong there. Continuing with the catch basin off to the left, one of a lot of people's favorite places to eat, Baja Fresh. They had a real problem there. It was seemed a bit an ongoing problem, just taking that mop bucket at the end of the night and dumping it out. You see some of our publications and our educational materials taped right to the door. I said, you know what? This is where the mop bucket goes every night. I think I'd like to just tape this right here. They were okay with that. And so we try to keep those messages right in front of them. And curb some of that behavior. If you like your coffee, Dutch Brothers had a problem. They kept washing mats out every night at the end of the shift. That catch basin leads to a filter box not too far away, and when I opened that up, it had about 6 inches of coffee grounds in it. And that was a whole lot of coffee grounds in there. So sometimes getting a hose out and washing is important for your business. It's important that you wash to the right place. The Dutch Brothers now all has mat clips and a mop sink in their building where they can clip the mat to the side of the wall of the mop sink, and then they can take a bit of a power rinse there and rinse out those mats at the end of the day that are covered with milk and syrup and coffee grounds and things like that. That was a great BMP that we were able to help them put into play. I mentioned structural BMPs, and we're on to system basics. This is an oil water separator. A lot of times you get to drive over the top of them, but you don't always get to open one up and see what's inside. On the left, I've got a clean one, but after it was a dirty one. And that's a good example of what an oil water separator can do. Dirty water in one side and cleaner water out the other. We also have some bioretention. When we slow that water down and we channelize it and move it through the landscape on the way to the MS4, we were able to capture a lot of solid materials, and grasses are able to pull up nutrients in the process. I like this slide because the Department of Ecology put it out, and we're beholden to them on a lot of things here under the permit. Local source control, or what we do there in the middle, a big connection to stormwater system maps. Our mapping system, supported by GIS and supported by Henry here, and the mapping work that he does, is pretty valuable to us. We're able to capture data and work with data on our iPads, and we're able to see what's going on under the ground. Spill response happens in the course of the work that I do also. Businesses do it. The orange stuff on the bottom is your Fred Meyer up in Salmon Creek. During the remodel, they closed out their paint center, threw everything in the dumpster. We got a couple inches of rain that night, and when Waste Connections picked up the drop box, everything came washing out the other end. That particular spill mapping came into place for us really, really well, because we were to find to work with Ecology to start at the spill and follow it all the way to that point where this is where you need to block off the system and start washing and pumping and get this stuff out of here before it leaves the property and gets to our MS4. Mapping also helps us identify something that I kind of coined pollution by design. Here we've got the Kaiser up in Salmon Creek. They're a compactor, a great BMP. It's undercover. There's no contact with rainwater or stormwater. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a drain there to begin with that happened to be tied into their system before they put the roof on. And compactors are notorious for belching out all kinds of things when they rust out on the bottom. And I hate to show you some dirty pictures here tonight, but that's where we're at. It's dirty work sometimes. Pollution by design is something that we really did back in the 90s. Here you can see a McDonald's on one side, Columbia Credit Union in the middle, and used to be Applebee's off to the right. You get four walls, you get a drain in the middle, sometimes you get water to wash with, and you can see with those green lines that all that stuff is connected to our system. And we spend a lot of time kind of undoing some of the stuff that we've done over the years, so it gets complicated. Here again is another McDonald's built back in the day, a little bit of an old school. We gave them a drain in the middle, we gave them a leaky dumpster, or they put in their leaker compactor. They like things nice and clean back there, and there it all goes, right to their system. So again, best management practices, a situation where we could do a lot more sweeping and a lot less washing. And here's a structural BMP in place now. That old McDonald's wanted to do some remodeling, and with some source control additions to our manual, we were able to say this is what dumpsters are going to look like in the future. We've got a roof over the top, they got their drain in the middle, and that drain is connected to sanitary sewer. So when you see a dumpster enclosure in the future, they're going to look more and more like this as time goes by. A good thing, because we can reduce that contact and we can release those pollutants. And they have a structural BMP in place to do the work for them. I just threw this in here because it's a funny picture, and it's a picture of me, and you can't see me right now, so here I am. This is what happens at multifamily when you pull a compactor away. You undo those hydraulic lines over there on the side, and 9 times out of 10, they leak all over the place, and whatever was coming out of the compactor kind of winds up everywhere. And we have some caps we can put over the top here when it's not in play. We have some absorbents we can use to capture hydraulic oil when they undo those couplings, and we can sweep this stuff up instead of wash it away. When I get in a leaky compactor, I have them dial down the pressure, and I have them work on the seals to make sure this thing isn't making such a mess like it used to be. Discharges happen from businesses on a frequent basis, and during the summertime you get to see what a mop bucket does every night all summer long when the rain doesn't wash it away. And we get some good visuals here for businesses. I'll show up when it's pouring down rain and they say, I don't see a problem. And if they do that all August long, their problem's going to make it pretty evident for them. So again, sometimes it's not too hard to figure out where the problems are coming for when people leave a trail like that. And even in the rainy weather, you can check it up on Dutch Brothers to make sure they're not washing mats at the end of the day. Again, this was before we put those BMPs in place. And this was a great driver. When I got to show this to corporate, they said, okay, we get it. We understand. So pictures can be worth 1,000 words. A lot of times we encounter fat soils and greases from hood cleaners who decide to do things outside in the parking lot with some hot, steamy water, to the effects down here of fat soils and greases over time as they turn into tars and clog up the pipes. We all know that biodiesel is a good thing, right? Well, when it's managed properly, yes, it is a good thing. When it's managed improperly, we just have pollution. We also get a lot of solids. I had a metal fabricator that had his own cutting board with grit, and he would move his grit outside and dewater it. He started hanging these bags over here inside, over a kiddie pool, and letting all those pollutants drain inside instead of outside. And he dewaters inside now, and he put a roof over the top of this whole outside space here. You can see off to the right here the mess that he was making. Great business. Again, businesses are busy. They're making money, but they're also making some pollutants at the same time. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention storm drains or floor drains. We do have some floor drains on the system. Normally, we bust up about three floor drains a year. That number seems to be dropping a little bit, which is a good thing. When we find them and we identify them, my first question is, do you know where that drain goes? 9 times out of 10, they say they don't. The next question is, do you need it? Do you use it? And they say, no, I don't use it. And I said, that's when we get out a bag of cement and we make it go away. Maintenance is an important factor when we're working with businesses. These catch basins fill up, and we use the education outreach arm of our group to create things just like this, our catch basin clean-out program. I think you've seen a presentation on this before, but this is one of the regular handouts for me, because when I do what I do, I find things like this, or find catch basins are filling up. It's time for some maintenance. The solid material in this catch basin has reached the point where it's moving into the system and moving out of their catch basin and sending those pollutants further into pipe to cause more problems down the line. If you're not familiar with our catch basin cleanout program, you can pull it from the presentation later, the website here at the top of the screen. If the business community signs up online, they can get that guaranteed price of $45. And that's a great tool to be able to pass on. I have a little bit of a quick little 3-minute video here I'd like to show you. I think it would help better demonstrate what some of our source control visits are like. And the link doesn't work because I'm on my supervisor's system here and he doesn't like what I'm using here. So without further ado, we'll give you a little bit of what a source control visit kind of looks like.
We're watching the video. I don't have audio for it. The video will be on our website in Bob's stormwater source control business pollution prevention presentation. Showing several different types of businesses and where he goes and some of the things that he runs into, and how various businesses have fixed their issues. And he's finished.
Whoa. And with that, I think we're out of time, folks. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me. There's my information. And if you have any questions now, we have time for them. I'm happy to entertain those as well. And I leave you with that last picture again, that gentleman out on Highway 99 who has to keep things clean to do his business and needs a drain to do it, just needs some best management practices to protect Tenny Creek.
This is Sue Marshall. I have a question.
Yes, Sue?
Yes. So I was wondering, when you go back every 5 years to some of these same businesses, how often are they just doing what you told them to do and everything's fine? Or how often is there a repeat problem or maybe a new problem comes up?
Yeah. I've got some businesses that I visit every year. It's just a matter of fact that they need some hand-holding. There's no doubt about it. And a lot of businesses have a manager, and managers come and go, like a lot of things. So I can tell you about a business, one business I go back to every 1 or 2 years, and I've seen 4 managers there since I've been working there, and I'm telling them some more things about their business they don't even know. So there's job security here. No problem with that.
And I think at what point does it, I know you don't like to, nobody likes enforcement, but maybe sometimes enforcement is the step after you've tried and tried and tried. How often do you have to resort to enforcement?
I want to say about 3, I'd like to say that I use my powers of persuasion as much as possible, and I like to lead with carrots instead of sticks. Every now and then you're gonna run into the guy that just has to be pushed or just wants to fight, and we start that process with a notice of violation. We can take it 2 steps further than that, but doing what I've done in years past now for about 6 years, I've never had to move past that notice of violation. That's the point where it gets a little serious for them and they go like, okay, I give in.
Great.
Because in the long run it's going to cost them more just to start sweeping instead of Washington. That's a whole lot cheaper than fighting the county or paying a fine.
Great.
Any other questions?
Yeah, real quick, Bob, I was going to ask, some of those photos that you show, you can clearly see that there's kind of the structural build-out ahead of time. It's kind of led to that. And I know businesses come and go and change, so it'd be hard to plan every single business that's going to be in place when all that construction is done. But do you see, with contemporary construction, a real effort to try to mitigate a lot of these things, or do you still kind of have to play catch up with that as well?
No doubt, new development, there are controls in place. You won't find an interior floor drain in new development that's connected to the MS4, to stormwater. There's a lot more controls in place. A lot of things are getting built in. And I see more and more responsibility as well. Just it comes with new stuff versus old stuff. You know what I mean? Does that answer your question? Yeah, definitely. Okay. That doesn't mean that we don't want to catch them early on, especially with the new businesses. It's great to get. I mean, there's always ways to circumvent great controls, and there's always ways to make a mess.
Yeah.
So
I guess that would be one other question I had is there any process when a business comes into practice that has to go through an initial inspection, or is there just not the resource to be playing that in tandem?
After about 6 years now, I got a pretty good handle on our business community. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of folks that come and go in certain business commercial properties, and we are required by our permit to update our inventory once every 5 years. And since our last update was in the last permit period in 2017, we are looking, I believe, 2022 for a business inventory update. And that'll be very interesting because we'll see a lot of businesses drop off, and we'll see a few new businesses come in as well. And businesses are changing hands all the time. If we had a business license system in Clark County that we could integrate with, that would be fantastic. A lot like a utility. That would be a great resource for us. Unfortunately, we kind of have to do things the hard way, but we can still get it done.
Nice. Well, if nobody else has any other questions, my thanks to you on behalf of the whole commission. Great presentation.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now?
And, thanks to Bob. Have a good evening there. And Chad, if you are ready for your part.
I am. Bob's a hard act to follow. So I'm having a small technical difficulty, so Alice is going to run my slideshow for me.
Okay.
If that's okay, Alice?
Yep. We're going to cross our fingers.
All right. So I'm Chad Oxing. I am the Monitoring and Assessment Supervisor. Bob gets all the dirty stuff. I get all the fun stuff. So I thought I would give you guys, this group, about a 20,000-foot view of what we do in clean water.
First question. So just a second. Can you see everybody?
I can.
Oh, Marie? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
So we go to the first slide, Alice. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
Okay. Okay.
It's being odd. Oh, it's being so strange. Let me try something else here.
Over.
I apologize. Okay. Why is it not? I'm sorry, guys. I practiced with Bob, but now. Okay, one more time.
All right.
Third time's the charm. I had too many of these things open.
I can try and open up the PDF. Maybe.
It just keeps kicking over to the big screen, so I guess I'll just have to do it this way.
Okay, that'll work.
And I can't see, so does that work for you, everybody?
Yeah, I think we can make that work.
Yeah, I can see it.
Okay. Okay.
Next slide. All right, so like I said, trying to give everybody a 20,000 foot view of what the monitoring and assessment crew does. And I'm starting with our most complex project that we have. So the status and trends monitoring of urban streams in Clark and Calhous counties in the lower Columbia River region. Big mouthful of something to say, so we gave it an acronym, LCUS, Lower Columbia Urban Streams. Now this study is mandated by our permit. I put a lot of information here and I apologize for that, but I did it on purpose in case you guys wanted to come back and take a look at it at a later time, but I will summarize. So Clark County is doing this project for DOE, and DOE is reimbursing Clark County over $460,000 to do it over the permit term to complete all project tasks. The project itself is funded by Clark County and other phase two permittees in both Calhous and Clark County. Just to give you an example of what we pay to DOE for this study is over $54,000 a year from last year through the permit term. But this agreement with Clark County doing the project allows us to recover those costs while acting as a contractor to DOE to complete the project. So that's the backbone of this project. So what does this project actually do? We can go to the next slide, Alex. Thank you. So what this project does, we have 5 trend sites that we monitor every year, and then there's 17 total status sites that we will monitor throughout the permit term. And we break those up into 3 or 4 sites a year. So each one of those status sites will get monitored 1 year over the permit term. And the data that we collect include continuous stage, continuous stream temperature, and continuous conductivity. And those are collected every 15 minutes, every day, throughout the entire water year. And in the summertime, we will be doing habitat monitoring, micro and macro invertebrate samples of the bugs that are in the streams, and a water quality sample. The map to your right shows a map of the entire set of sites that we will look at over the next 5 years. And to the left of that is a site set up for a status site. And so inside those two tubes, there's a stage sensor that measures the height of the water and a conductivity probe that measures continuous conductivity. And these sites are designed to be movable, so I can take the site, which is that current creek, and I can move it to one of next year's sites. And so they are meant to be relocated. The picture next to that, to the left, is a trend site. This site's a lot more robust. It's made to be there for the next 5 years and longer if we continue to run this program beyond the permit term. And you can see pipes going from the enclosure to the stream. And then there is also a pressure transducer to measure stage or height of the water and a different type of conductivity probe. And the trend sites are kind of cool because inside the box, I have a picture later on that I'll show you, but the guts of this thing allow it to collect data, hold the data, and transmit the data to me every day without having to go into the field to collect the data. So it's a lot more costly to set up, but it saves a lot of money over the 5-year period just for staff time. Next one, Alice, please. Okay, so delay on my end now. Our next big, basically, project that we have is the Wadeable Streams project. And this has 9 index sites, or sites that we go to every month, every year, for like the last 10 years plus, and moving forward. This one has also rotating panel sites, probably 55 of them, where we visit 9 to 11 every year on a 5-year cycle. So those sites get looked at 1 year over 5 years. And the parameters that we collect on this one are a little bit different. Here we collect monthly water quality parameters, the bug samples again, and we use those data as we send them to the lab, get them back, we run it through what's called the OWQI for the water quality. That is the Oregon Water Quality Index. And what it does, it calculates a score for the overall health of the stream, anywhere from poor to excellent. And the BIBI scores use the bug data, and it spits out the similar scoring metric from poor to excellent. And the way it does that is we go out and collect the bug sample, a composite sample, send it to the lab, and based on the number of individuals and the types of critters that are in there, it spits out a score. And those two tend to mesh really well. The OWQI score meshes pretty good with the BIBI score. So if one's poor, the other one is usually poor as well. So it gives us a more robust analysis for the overall health of the stream. So why do we collect these data? Well, we're going to use them to update the 2010 Stream Health Report. Those data will be represented and incorporated into StoryMap, which I'm sure this group has heard of already, right? Okay. We can go to the next slide, Alice, please. We'll give you an idea what that's kind of going to look like. This is a page from the 2010 Stream Health Report. This is Sam Rickery. And you can see all the subwatersheds within. Oh, I'm sorry.
Where do you want me?
When you go up one. Back one.
Okay. I was right. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Sure. So if you look at the table on the left hand side, you see let's look at Mill Creek. So you have your water quality, which is your OWQI score, and that's poor. You have your biological health, which is your BIBI score, and that's fair. And then next to it, we have flow, which I'll talk about next, but that's poor as well for Mill Creek. So looking at Salmon Creek watershed as a whole, you notice that the subwatersheds in the upper portion or the headwater areas are excellent or fair and good. And as Salmon Creek flows down and becomes flowing through more urban area and receives more stormwater runoff, you see that the scores are becoming just fair and poor. And that's pretty typical for pretty much any of the watersheds in Clark County. The headwater areas are more forested, more rural, and as you go downstream, it becomes more urbanized and influenced by stormwater and less trees, basically. So pretty typical. How about the next one, Alice, please? Okay, so when we talk about flow, we're talking about hydrology. And so we have six hydrology sites throughout the county, Mill Creek being one of them, Cougar Creek, Jones Creek. We have two stations in Whipple Creek, Upper and Mid, and one at Packer Creek. And the county also operates and maintains six rain gauges throughout the county as well. If we start at the picture in the upper right-hand corner, that's actually the hydro site for Mill Creek. So that's what is at Mill Creek right now. It has been for a long time. When we talk about the guts, we can go to the picture below that. So inside the steel enclosure is a dry box, and that houses my data logger, my modem, power converter, and so it allows it to collect all the data every 15 minutes, store it for a day, and then it gets shipped to me every day. So that is pretty nice to have. The next picture to the left of that's Ben Joner, our hydro guy. He's setting up the transect to measure discharge in Mill Creek. And why that's important will be on the next slide. But basically what he does, he records the stage, where it's at, and then conducts a discharge so we can calculate how much water is moving over time based on that stage. And the picture to the left of that is our precip station at the treatment plant. And that's a pretty much a typical setup for a precip station. Let me go next slide, Alice. So here is where it gets very complicated. So I'll try and keep it very, very simple. But we house all of our continuous data in a program called Aquarius. And from the continuous stage, we can calculate or estimate continuous discharge. So I'll just talk about two or three boxes because there's a lot of work that goes on the back side of this, but I won't get into that. But if you look at the upper left-hand corner of the box, you'll see a red straight line with a bunch of green dots on it. And those green dots are actually field measurements at that particular stage. So the red line represents our calculated discharge for those measurements. And then the box below that is the actual rating curve itself. And so notice all the dots on the curve line up perfectly, and that's the way a good rating curve should look. So we have a high confidence that the discharge that we're estimating at any stage in that arc there, that little curve, is pretty darn good. Notice that there's no dots way to the right of that line, because then it's too dangerous to get into the water during those higher flows to get a measurement. So, and like I said, all this stuff is really complex. Hydrology is really complex. If we go to the box to the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a bunch of green dots with these red arms, right? That's the way we adjust our rating curves. If you think about water depositing rock or silt, it could artificially raise the stage. So then you need to adjust your curve to account for that. Or during high flows, you have a scour event where it will decrease your stage with the same amount of water going through. And so all those little arms are us shifting the data to make sure our curve is accurate. But that's about as deep as I'm going to dive into that. Here we go, next slide. Another big project we do is illicit discharge detection and elimination screening, or IDE. This is done in the summertime during dry weather. We're basically looking for any flow that's in our MS4 that is not supposed to be there. So I put together a little flow chart that we use to let you know that if we're outside sampling and we pull a manhole lid and we see flow, or we're at a discharge point or an outfall and we see flow during the dry season, we take a sample. We send those samples to the lab, and if it comes back high in fecal coliform bacteria, surfactants, or ammonia potassium, it kind of gives us a tool about where these discharges could be coming from. Could be coming from a cross connection from sanitary sewer. We found a couple of those that we found throughout the program. Wash water, found a couple of those and fixed them. Or it could be just irrigation or water seeping into our pipes, and that happens a lot too. So, and IDE work also supports Bob's source control work as well. So when you find something that you can't figure out where it's coming from, we go and track it down. So we track it up upstream of the storm sewer system that he was showing on the maps. So we go next slide, Alice. And a new thing that we've been doing over the past couple of years is called microbial source tracking. So I'm going to go back to, let's just start with Whipple Creek. So we've been looking at Whipple Creek, taking samples for well over a decade. We know that there's a fecal coliform issue. So this was kind of our pilot project, and what microbial source tracking does, we take a water sample, we ship it all the way to Florida, and they're able to sequence it, extract all the DNA out of it, and let us know exactly what source that DNA came from. So it's pretty slick, it's pretty new. Whipple Creek was our pilot project. So with this particular one, we knew that fecal coliform was high in Whipple Creek, so we wanted to hit all the tributaries to Whipple Creek, which is what you're seeing outlined in pink. Those are the drainage areas for those tribs. And we sampled six times each site, three in the dry season, three in the wet season. We did a land use analysis. I mean, we looked at the different types of land use and septic tank compliance too, as well. And not surprisingly, it's about 30% of the septic tanks in Whipple Creek are not in compliance with their inspection frequency standard. So given that, we found human DNA at all locations. We found dog DNA at all locations. And I was expecting to see beaver DNA at all locations too, because there's a lot of beaver activity in the Whipple Creek watershed. But only one site had it. So that was surprising to me. And then we also use a tool that's called an optical brightener, and that basically you stick in the water and it tells you how much whiteners are in the water. Now whiteners are coming from your dishwashing detergent for your clothes. They come from toilet paper, from napkins, so they're an indicator of potential septic issues.
and all the values that we found in all of our samples were above background values. So those data were given to public health, and they're working on septic compliance in those areas. So good work there. We also did the MST in the East Fork tributaries. East Fork has a problem with fecal coliform as well. And basically, all samples that we tested in McCormick Creek, Jenny Creek, Breezy Creek, Rock Creek North, all had human DNA in their water samples. And they all had dog DNA in their water samples. So, and then all samples also had higher OB or optical brightener values as well. So these results are being used currently to help support the East Fork Lewis TMDL alternative. And future MIST samples are going to continue in this watershed to support the Poop Smart Park DOE-funded grant. So a lot of good work. We go next one, Alice, please. All right, the last MIST project I want to talk about, we just completed last year. We took some data from a study I did back in 2009 where I sampled the tributaries of Samurai Creek in the lower part of the watershed. And so we didn't have much data for these tribs, but we found out that they had a lot of fecal coliform issues in pretty much every sample that I took. So we hit them again with the MST, but we only tested for dog DNA, and we had dog DNA in every sample. And then the OB levels were greater than background in all samples but one, I think. So the results of this study are going to help support the Salmon Creek TMDL and provide data for canines for clean water for the outreach and education program. So again, a lot of good work, a lot of data being collected, and doing good work with it. Next slide, Alice, please. Two big things we got this year. We got two grants from DOE, which is great. I've been at the county a long time, and it's my first grant that I applied for, and we got it. So what this project does, I think the total cost is just over $210,000. We got awarded $163,000 and change. What this is going to do is basically revegetate just over 3,500 feet of riverbank on the East Fork Lewis River. Total 13.23 acres of riparian area will be re-established. And over the next 2 years, we're going to have a lot of work planting almost 18,000 native trees and shrubs. So, and this work, over time, as those trees and shrubs grow, are going to provide shade to the East Fork, and that's going to help support the East Fork Lewis River TMDL as well. And the biggest one we got is the Heritage Farm Wetland Restoration. Total cost of that's over $1.4 million. We got awarded $500,000. This is going to restore 6 acres of wetland, establish 2.7 acres of riparian buffer, and this is in the headwaters of Cougar Creek, which drains the Salmon Creek. So it protects the Salmon Creek. The project supports the Salmon Creek temperature TMDL as well. So a lot of good stuff. And we gave the last one, Alice. Now, a lot of what we do is we build partnerships with a lot of other Phase 2 permittees, such as Calais County, Battleground, Washougal, Camas, Vancouver. We help out and supply data to DOE for a lot of their East Fork stuff, Samurai Creek data, and they're coming out next year, or maybe starting this year, with Lackness Creek fecal coliform study, which we provided them all of our historic data to help them out in our sampling locations. We partnered with the City of Camas. We monitored Jones Creek Forum. We're about to conduct MIST in the City of Los Center, not next week, but I'll be out there the week after that collecting samples. I'm just out there today scoping out two sites, and there's sites that they want me to look at will work. We also have the Monitoring Resource Center, and that's basically, we loan out the same equipment that we use to collect the data that we have, and that's open to anybody, so members of the public, other agencies, so we have that as well. We're part of the East Fork Lewis River Partnership. As you know, we have an outstanding education and outreach program, We provide data for them to give them some research on what they want to do for some of their projects. Source control we help out with. And like I said, all of our projects generate a massive amount of data, just tons of data. And we get data requests from other agencies, from members of the public, from teachers, and we give our data out for free. So with that, I don't know what time frame I had, but I'll take any questions if there are any. Crickets, is that good, huh? I didn't think so.
I have one question, which is just, is there not a closer laboratory to do the analysis? Because I think you said it goes to Florida.
For the MST work, it does. That's the only lab in the U.S. that does that type of work. So for all of our other water quality parameters that we collect, it goes up to the lab up in Kelso.
I have to say that MST work is really pretty fascinating. Hadn't heard so much about the whitening, the use of the whiteners either, as a tracer, yeah. Sort of.
Yeah, it's just different tools that we now have that we can use, that we can do this type of work. Because we know there's an issue, we know there's a problem, but where is it coming from? This allows you to kind of pinpoint areas where you're getting hits of human or dog, and then what can you do to basically correct that problem. The Whipple Creek is a great example. You know, we got human at every site. You can look at the drainage areas and say, okay, there's five parcels here that haven't had the septic tank looked at in, I don't know, 10, 15 years. So then you give those data to the health department, and they're trying to figure out how to approach that to get them into compliance.
Chad, this is Sue Marshall. I work with a group of stakeholders who are interested in Heritage Farm. They're gardeners, they're master gardeners. As part of our outreach, I was thinking that it'd be very a contact person, somebody who could talk to the group.
Yeah, I think they are meeting actually this week, maybe even perhaps tomorrow. I will email the person that I know is in charge of that grant and let them know.
Oh, okay. And it's not the, there is a larger stakeholder group that came together when there was some doubt what was going to be happening with Heritage Farm. So it's about 20 people that I've convened via Zoom, so... If you could just shoot me whoever the contact person is, I would follow up with them.
Okay, great. Alice, I assume you can send me Sue's email address?
Yes.
Okay.
Great.
Actually, I'll hop in really quick, Chad and Alice. This is Jeff. Yep. Sue, you can actually just kind of go through me at this point on that project. I'm sort of acting
Happy
as
to.
The... I'm acting as the pretend... project manager until we get a real one who knows what they're doing from the folks in Public Works. But as Chad said, we're gonna have our kind of project kickoff meeting with a number of folks, and I believe his name is Joe Zimmerman, who is the main farm manager, will be there, as well as Pat Lee, who is overseeing the farm for the county for parks. So I'll have some of the parks folks in that meeting to kind of kick off our formal project now that the grant is up and running. So uh-huh. We'll be getting going on that. That meeting is tomorrow, actually, as Chad said.
Okay.
But I'd be more than happy to chat with the group that you've got as well to kind of make sure they're brought into the loop. So,
I think they'll be very supportive. It'd just be good to know the parameters and... That'd be great. I'll follow up with you.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Jeff.
Perfect. All right. Thank you. Nice to meet you guys.
Thanks,
yeah,
Chad.
Hey, thank you very much for that. That's fantastic. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I second what you were saying there, Michelle, about the different stuff that they're able to test for. It's really fascinating with that kind of inspiring, and for me, a little bit uplifting with, like, being able to monitor stuff to that degree now. It was great. Alice, next on the agenda, I know you got a staff liaison report bullet there. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to...
Not a lot. Yes. Yeah, just a couple little things. Just not a lot. First of all, they are advertising for the clean water manager position, and hopefully certain people will apply. So I hope we get some really good candidates who will apply, and we'll be able to move forward and have a replacement from Dean, because it's been, oh gosh, nearly 2 years now. We are also, just in case anybody has anything urgent, I am going to be out of the office next week, so contact Jeff. He may or may not be available, so if you do need it, you can call or email the Clean Water main line. You can either email or you can call, and the number for the main line is 564-397-4345. And somebody will get back to you. The other admin staff check that on a regular basis, at least once or twice a day, so we can get back to you if there's something that's going on. And then I wanted to talk with you a little bit about it to see what your thoughts are and when you would like to have this presentation. Last March, before COVID all hit, you had indicated that you would like to have somebody come in and talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and the overly impacted populations and how overburdened populations and their relation with clean water and what we can do as a body and shaping that. So I wanted to check and find out, would you want something in May, July, September, so I can start coordinating that and getting that set up? Because I was thinking we'll try and maybe do one meeting every once in a while, have another speaker come in and talk for a little bit.
I would say if you could line something up for May, we'd be fine with that.
Okay.
I don't think we have, you know, we got the annual report out of the way, so... we shouldn't be too pressed on any other big projects at that point.
Okay. And that's all I have. I don't have anything else, so really light on my side, so that's a good thing, right? Yes, Michelle?
Question for you.
Okay.
I thought that the annual report went really well. Has there been any feedback on it, or...
I haven't heard anything, probably at Jeff's level. He has probably heard more than I have. No news is good news in my book. I didn't hear anything negative, and I did. You guys did a really good job in presenting it. Again, Brendan, good job. Thank you for giving that presentation. It did go really well. So, Jeff, do you have anything? Maybe.
I'll turn on my video this time.
Okay.
I don't. Other than you know, the reaction from the council was, I thought, very positive and very supportive of what you all are doing, and very appreciative. So I thought that was great. Brendan did a nice job in presenting and fielding questions. It was nice that several of you were able to be there. I think that always, you know, comes across well when we have that kind of support. So, yeah, I, beyond the actual event, I haven't heard any other feedback, but as Alice said, that's often a good thing, right? Because some of the feedback we would get is like, what about this? What about that? So I was real pleased with how we did there. So,
is there something cooking around Lacamas Lake? Is there
something cooking?
Well... a movement around more focus on some of the water quality issues, sort of like along the lines of the Vancouver Lake.
Yeah, there is. There is, and City of Camas is really the lead entity on all of that, as far as the lake work itself and that kind of effort. And then, of course, ecology will be starting their TMDL work. I think Chad might have mentioned a little bit about that in his presentation. They're kind of ramping up for their watershed work. Camas is in the process of selecting a consultant team to come in and help them develop a lake management plan for the Three Lakes system. So they are hoping to have that group on board, you know, probably functioning by, say, June or July. And then it'll probably be a couple of years while they are either, you know, doing some studies, possibly some, I mean, there may be some sort of early implementation type of work that could be done. So right now they're just kind of sorting through their proposals. And so that's kind of the main driver. Clark County, we're just kind of in the support role at this point. So, you know, I am in contact very regularly with Camas folks, and we're providing some of the historical data and reports, and we're helping with the RFQ, that kind of stuff. So we have a hand in it, but we're just kind of playing a technical support role for now. So that help?
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep.
One thing that struck me was a comment by Councillor Lentz. It seemed that she was asking us to provide information or advice or something related to development. I'm not sure if it was in the context of the revision of the comprehensive plan, but there was development and water quality linked together, and I'm not quite sure what she had in mind.
My sense was that the councilor was referring to the growth management planning and that realm. Stormwater is not one of the required elements, if I understand correctly, for that planning process, but it is one that certainly would have some potential impact on those types of planning exercises. So I think that might have been where Councillor Lentz was heading with that thought. I'm not actually sure what the next iteration of planning along those lines is for the county. That's done through community development department, but definitely something that should be kept on the radar, I think, and sort of brought back up as a, you know, a way that we can leverage some of the information and the knowledge that we have in clean water, stormwater realm, and, you know, maybe make some inroads into decision making on the planning end of things. So. Yeah.
Right. The thought I had is if there's an opportunity to avoid impacts when you're doing that comprehensive planning, looking at the whole landscape, I guess that's what I thought might be provide some opportunities. The update of the comp plan is due in 2025, so we've got a few years to think about it.
Great. Well, if we don't have anything else, I will let us adjourn for the evening and call it a wrap. Thank you, Alice, for putting these together. Those were some great presentations this evening. That was a lot of really good info.
Thank you. And I'll make sure everything's out on the website as well as your other stuff. And I think I sent you all the PFDs of the PowerPoints, and I sent the veg management plan. So you'll have that, and then we'll get it out on the website tomorrow.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. See you guys
in
May.
Yeah. Have a good evening.
Marie has a question.
Wait, Marie.
Can we send a little note of thanks to the presentation presenters?
Yeah.
They did a great job. So. Bob's still here. Turn your mouth off. Yeah. I think that'd be nice. Everyone needs a little pick up from these times.
Hey, thanks for having us, and thank you guys for serving on the commission. Thanks for contributing your time. It's much appreciated.
Yes.
Likewise. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Thank you.
Everybody have a good evening. Try to catch some sun tomorrow.
Yes.